Lori Summers, this is her, I believe, second time that Lori has done a brown bag in this series. Last time she was talking about turpentine workers in Georgia, because at that time Lori was a researcher and instructor and teacher at Valdosta State in Georgia. Well, we're very happy that Lori decided to move home here to Michigan, along with her fine husband, Dave, and I am lucky enough to have them as neighbors as well as colleagues, so it's great to have them here. Lori has been working with the Fishtown Preservation Society as a consultant and as a trained folklorist. She's done work on Beaver Island. She's done a variety of things in her life as an ethnomusicologist. So it's just it's wonderful that Lori is joining us. I have to tell you that being raised as I was in the UP in Escanaba, the fishery there was very strong when I was very, very small. So that I have great memories, and many of you might have similar memories if you were raised on the Great Lakes, of going down after the fishing boats had come in, fish were actually already cleaned, and you could get a fresh fish fry on the dock, and my parents would get one for us kids, and then they would go out, but they were always served between two paper plates, and one turned upside down, put in a bag, and handed it to you out of the fishery. So I think I have strong memories of that. It'll be interesting to see the Leland story. So please join me in welcoming Lori Summers as she talks about Brotherhood of the Lake, commercial fishing, work, and livelihood in Leland's fish town. Lori Summers.
Network meeting in Saugatuck in May, and in the attempt to lure people into our session, as there were concurrent sessions, we had we had sound effects like seagulls and lapping waves, and we also had, more importantly, whitefish pate and fresh smoked whitefish that had been imported directly from Leland by the Fishtown Preservation Society Director Amanda Holmes. Unfortunately, as you can see, all you got is me today, so sorry about that aspect of it. I'm pleased to be upside down.
Oh, that's not good. Okay. There, can you hear me better now? Right side up is always good.
Yeah.
All right. I do want to say that the work I'm going to be speaking of today is about today, as John mentioned, was for the Fishtown Preservation Society in Leland. The work was for a historic structures report, and it was funded, I will give credit to the Jeffries Heartland Fund, to the National Trust for Historic Preservation. I do also want to say that although the photograph that you're looking at is mine, there'll be a number, of wonderful documentary black and white photographs. You'll just have a sampling of them that were done by Erhard Peters. He was a native of Leland, and his collection of photographs of the Great Lakes from Leland, and he later worked on the car ferries, are really one of the great documentary collections of photographs of working life on the Great Lakes from the 20s through the 40s. And actually, because he lived in Leland, the pictures from Leland span a longer time frame than that. And I also want to give credit to colleagues whose oral interviews have enriched my work in Leland and this presentation. That includes Amanda Holmes, the Fishtown Preservation Director, who also happens to be a folklorist, Michael Sharapa, a colleague from Western Michigan University, whose book Fish for All was published by MSU Press, and he did a number of interviews with fishermen in Leland, and also the Leland Historical Society and their then-director, Laura Quackenbush, who did a number of wonderful interviews with fishermen who were deceased by the time I came along, but who were from the generation of classic Leland fishermen that I'll be speaking about a bit today. You'll see here in the first slide, which you've probably been grimly staring at now for a few minutes, Fishtown today. The boat in the foreground is the Joy. I'll speak more about the boats later, but this is the most recent of two working fish boats that are operating out of Leland Harbor today. A trap net boat that was built in Leland by fisherman Ross Lang in 1980 and 81. All right, so much for the button. There we go. I also want to say that my topic and the way I approach it is based in my work as a folklorist. I came across this wonderful little quote from the Leland Enterprise about stories that fishermen tell about their life on the lakes and their work and colorful characters of fishermen, past and present. And so the approach that I take to the work, although I look at least in the historic structures report, we looked at Leland in terms of the place, the geography and the cultural landscape of the place. It's informed by all these interviews that are infused by the stories that fishermen tell that give you a really sense, for those of us who have not had the good fortune to be out in the lake in a fish boat, what it's like to do this kind of work. Here is Fishtown today, and I've tried to take this shot, which is not the most poetic way to shoot Fishtown today, as it's taken from the dam looking out towards Lake Michigan. And in the foreground are two large mid-century modern structures, a hotel and a restaurant, which were built in the 1960s. The rest of the buildings are, for the most part, historic fishing shanties, net sheds, and an ice house. Here's a more or less that same view from the peak fishing period in about 1940. So you can see some of the similarities and some of the differences, and I'll talk a bit more about that later, but that just gives you a sense. And this is one of Earhart Peters' photos that I was mentioning previously. Fishtown is a Survivor is one of the monikers of the Fishtown Preservation Society, and I just wanted to start with a little bit about how special Fishtown is. And John mentioned his boyhood. We won't discuss exactly how long ago that was, in Escanaba, but commercial fishermen are a vanishing breed in the Great Lakes in general and Michigan in particular, since that's our topic for today. Fishtown has two active fish licenses currently by state mandated, so state issued, as opposed to Indian licenses. Pretty unusual, and you'll see an image of that in a minute, for Lake Michigan. The image shows Bruce Price, who's the grandson and son of and great-grandson of commercial fishermen. He himself is not a fisherman. It was designated in the last year one of the places that matter by the National Trust for Historic Preservation. Standing in front of Diversions now, a fish shanty, historic fish shanty, actually one of the oldest fish shanties still standing in Fishtown, built in 1905, which was the first to be rehabilitated by the Fishtown Preservation Society when they acquired the property in 2007 from fisherman Bill Carlson and his brothers. And then you have the historic ice house, more about that in a bit, in the top left. And below that, Carlson's of Fishtown, which is really what makes, I think, Fishtown a true survivor. A lot of waterfronts in Michigan and elsewhere have now become tourist sites. They're places for charter fishermen and yachters and so forth. There are relatively few working waterfronts left. And what you're looking at in the lower left-hand corner is the retail side of Carlson's of Fishtown, which is the active commercial fishery operating Fishtown today, about to be handed on, currently run by the fourth generation of Carlson's and about to be handed over to the fifth. When I mentioned a dying breed or Here's, I think, some graphics that are quite telling. I'm pleased to be able to show the one on the left, which is from the Atlas of Michigan, which was MSU's bicentennial project and happened to have been edited by my late father, Lawrence Summers, and it shows just in the from data from 1974, you see the locations of commercial fishing ventures all around Michigan. Leland would be here, more or less, and even today now the bulk of the fishery in Michigan is centered still in that area around Alpena and on the Lake Huron side. But I have here on the right an image from, it shows Lake Michigan, and it shows you how reduced the commercial fishing has become for a number of reasons, which I'll mention. Here's the fishery down in Muskegon, of which there are the Petersons and the Jensens share a license, and actually the Petersons have been fishing for the Fishtown fishermen just this last season, and before that they were supplying fish for sale in Fishtown. And here you have waters that are fished by the commercial fishing out of Leland, the two licenses that are there. The rest are, you see tribal waters, and you see some fishery over on the Wisconsin side of the lake. And the, but basically, we're down to two groups of commercial fishermen on the on this coast of Lake Michigan, as you can see what it was just in the mid-70s. And the statistics on top are not quite parallel. It's amazing how difficult it is to find out how many commercial fishing licenses have been issued in Michigan. But a recent, if you heard their Environment Report series on Michigan radio, they said about 50. Sea Grants is about 45. But in 1930, that 2,237 is not actually fishing licenses, that's commercial fishermen. So if you counted the number of commercial fishermen, there are more fishermen perhaps than licenses, but you can see how drastically reduced it has become for a number of reasons. One has to do with the American Indian Treaty rights, the 1979 Fox decision that affirmed earlier the treaty rights from 1836, the Treaty of Washington, in which treaty signatory tribes gave up land rights but not hunting and fishing rights, and that's what was affirmed in the Fox decision of 1979. And interestingly enough, all that affected drastically a number of other non-native commercial fisheries. What I heard through this research, and which is not really written down anywhere, is that the Grand Traverse Bay Band of Chippewa and Ottawa decided that they didn't want to put the Leland fishermen out of business, so they made the cutoff line north of most of the traditional fishing grounds for the Leland fishermen, so they were able to stay in business. Another thing that happened, however, was that in managing the fisheries, of course, you know that the DNR developed a policy that was quite controversial among commercial fishermen to support the sports fishery over the commercial fishery, and a number of regulations just made it increasingly difficult for commercial fishermen to continue. And in Leland, what was really a turning point occurred in 1975 when they had been fishing for chubs primarily after the lamprey came in and really started to affect the fishery in Leland in 1948. And they turned to chubs, and that was sort of the mainstay that got them through a very lean time in Leland and other places. But in the state was concerned that the chub fishery was becoming overfished, and so they developed a lottery system for research licenses to monitor the population, and each region was designated with one license. And just by the luck of the draw, literally, Bill Carlson came up with the lottery number for Leland and was so able to survive through that that period. So it's really been a somewhat dramatic story of luck as well as skill to keep going. Bill Carlson, pictured here in a recent photo, gets a lot of press. He's been a major figure in the fisheries since he became involved actively, coming back from school where he was studying to be an actor and helping when his uncle became sick in the fishery in the 60s and really stayed and never left. And the reason this title, The Man Who Saved Fishtown, comes from a publication in the Traverse City recently when Fishtown Preservation Society acquired the property. But Bill Carlson was really the one that began to buy up property as fishermen died or sold off and weren't able to keep going with all these challenges that I was mentioning. And when a shanty would become available, he and his brothers developed a consortium and began to buy up property. And he basically held on until, it's a long story, but eventually he formed Fishtown Preservation Society and then as a nonprofit and looked around for somebody basically to take it over. And Fishtown Preservation Society did so. They raised $2.5 million in less than a year to acquire the property in 2007. Just a little bit about the fishery itself. Bill Carlson, as you see in this quote, realized that with all the challenges that the fishery was facing, and when they were down to basically a research license for chubs and eventually a trap net license, that they weren't going to be able to just fish for a living. And so he moved into processing and wholesale and retail. On the top left photograph, you see them making trout sausage, which is one of the things that's not unique to Carlson's, that is done by, but one of the things that they have done, whitefish pate that I mentioned at the outset, is another product. They also do beef and turkey jerky in season. And then you see the retail counter in Fishtown at Carlson's in the lower left-hand corner. And the fact that Fishtown was morphing into, beginning really in the, there's always been a tourism presence in Fishtown, and it's been, as some of you may even have property up there, a destination for resorters since the late 19th century. And a lot of Chicago and other Midwestern cities' money was up there, and that's part of the reason that they were able to come up with the money to purchase Fishtown. But also those people would go down and there was a small retail market all along. But tourism really took off in the 60s and 70s, and Carlson's was able to tap into that both by the using fishery buildings for low-impact retail and also for their own sales. But it isn't just the local fresh market sales. They only market now as far south as Traverse City. They no longer have their own store in South Traverse City. If you go to Traverse City, they used to own Burritt's, but that's now owned by somebody else, which is still a fish market there. You see the list of restaurants and stores and other businesses where they, during the height of the season, where they sell fish. This is Jeremy White, I don't know if he graduated. He was a football player. Can you tell by looking at his build? Who works in the fishery in the summer, and there he's vacuum packing fish for various clients. In the lower right-hand corner, it's kind of fuzzy, but this is a Chevrolet ad that's actually showing an earlier system before government regulations kind of determined much what the fishery looked like and how fish were held and marketed, where they would just go around and peddle smoked fish from the back of the truck down near Sleeping Bear and around the area. They no longer do that, but they do sell smoked fish in Carlson's, and more on that later. The other interesting thing is over here in the lower left-hand corner, you have an image of Bill Fowler and his crew. Bill fishes for the Grand Traverse Bay Band of Ottawa and Chippewa. And if any of you know anything about sort of the history of contested waters on the Great Lakes, and some of the really bad feelings from non-native fishermen about these treaties and the fishing rights issues that came up in the 70s and 80s. In Leland, there's a very amicable relationship now, and they moor their boat, not in Fishtown, but in Leland Harbor, and sell a number, you know, they regularly sell fish to Carlson. The fishery has changed in a number of ways. We've talked about some of the ways just in terms of marketing and the changes in government policy and so forth. Here's just some images of the changes in Fishtown itself over the years. One of the earliest photographs from about 1900 in the upper left-hand corner, where you see the first fish shanty sort of clustering at the mouth of the Carp, now called Leland River. Then you have the image I showed before from the peak fishing period about 1940, just before the incursion of the Lamprey into Lake Michigan. In the lower left-hand corner, you have Fishtown in the 1960s. And here is the most recent fish shanty actually built in Fishtown. It was built around 1960. The rest of the buildings really date to the 1920s and earlier. And this is another one of the ways that Fishtown is a survivor. This is Fishtown today in the lower right. I was struck, because I don't know if anyone else has made an obsessive vacation event like Amanda Holmes, the Fishtown director, has, of going to fishery sites around the Great Lakes. But she photographed them all, and Fishtown is looking pretty good in contrast. Not only is it a survivor just because it still has a fishery going into the fifth generation, there are other places where there are multiple generation fishing families. That's not uncommon. But what is increasingly unique is that you have these historic buildings that have managed to survive the ice, the wind, the rising and lowering of the lake levels from basically 1903, when the earliest surviving building was constructed, to the present. On the original site, where there's still an active working waterfront, that is increasingly rare and is making Fishtown quite special. And there's talk of trying to, it's currently on the National Register of Historic Places, and there's talk of listing it as a National Historic Landmark. It wasn't the biggest fishery, never was, but it's a survivor. And that's kind of where we are right now, that we have so many of these. The buildings may remain with no fishery. The fishery may remain in Quonset huts or pole barns. But here you have everything and its original site. This just shows you, though, that although the original site, this is a fishery. It's adapted. It's changed. These buildings were not pickled in time. We did imprints of sort of a timeline development of Fishtown. And you see the red buildings showing buildings that were constructed in the first decade of the 20th century. And there's a picture of kind of that era, and about 1907. I just want to point out, although it's kind of an obscure little detail, this dock, which was like 100 feet long, 60 feet wide, had this warehouse on the end of it, and it completely disappeared. It was the so-called big blow of 1913. You know, we've had big storms in Lake Michigan, took out breakwaters in Milwaukee, Chicago, just wiped this thing out. And you just think, with those kinds of storms, that these fish shanties have survived, even though that one, of course, is a lot more vulnerable out there, it's still an amazing survivor. And then down at the bottom, you see there's only very few red buildings left. There's a number of blue ones from the 20s. The big green ones are these huge hotel and restaurant that were constructed in the 60s, some other buildings constructed in the 70s. But these were more constructed to fit in with the look of Fishtown itself. So there's definitely been changes, but there's much that is retained from the history of Fishtown. I just want to, I am going to spend time on life on the lakes and the fishery, but I think it's important just to situate the place. Like many fisheries, it's where the river meets the lake, and in this case, Lake Michigan, but if you know Leland, it's this little short river goes between Lake Leelanau, originally called Carp Lake, and Lake Michigan, and here's Fishtown. This is from an older postcard, probably from the, I would guess, the 1950s, although there's no date on it. And even the early explorers that came through were just stunned by what a gorgeous area it was. And I just love that quote by Alexander Winchell, who was a geologist and zoologist, biologist, sort of general scientist for the University of Michigan, who did an early survey of the area. Also, one of the distinctive things about Leland as you go is you can see the Manitou Islands from the shore, and the relationship between the Manitous and Leland has been an important one. Some of the early fishing families began on the Manitous and then came to the mainland. There's still a ferry that leaves from Leland, from Fishtown, that goes to the Manitous that also is now in its fourth generation of the same family that's running that, the Grosvenor family. And the image on the left is from the Manitou Passage Underwater Preserve. This is a Manitou Passage, a shipping lane. The fish boats are crossing back and forth with all these large freighters, past and present. I have quite a spellbinding story I heard about that I'll share with you in a minute. But it's a distinctive place in terms of geography because of that location along the Manitous and the Manitou Passage. Also, the river has been crucial through the development of Fishtown and the way that it developed. Initially, the river, of course, was a site for a historic Ojibwa town. This was a town of over 200 people. When the young geologist Bella Hubbard accompanied Douglas Houghton in 1838 on a peninsula survey of the Michigan coast, he stopped at the mouth of the Carp River, now the Leland River, on the Fishtown site, and made this remarkable sketch of what the settlement was like of the Ottawa town at that time. There was no mention in his description or his drawings of fishing per se, but we know that fishing was, of course, the reason they settled there, fishing up the river into the Carp Lake and venturing out into Lake Michigan in canoes, and then later in commercial fish boats. A little bit more about the river and Fishtown, that the fishing really was kind of slow to develop in this particular area, in part because of the Leland Ironworks that dominated the entire north side of the river and was putting slag and all sorts of fish-friendly items into the river and lake there, and also just dominating the landscape. And there were also sawmills with cordwood, and that's what you see in the two pictures, the picture here, coming down through the river and out into the lake. So the very first picture we have sort of the end of the sawmill area when lawsuits and various things regarding the demise of the ironworks finally cleared land on the north side of the river. You see Mackinaw boats, the early fish boats in the river, and a fish shanty in the foreground. And this is really, even though we know there were fishermen in Leland as early as 1864, that's the first reference. It really didn't begin on a large scale until 1900. And here you have a picture again of Fishtown from its earlier days. Pete Carlson, who was the father of Bill, was a third-generation fisherman, one that was interviewed by Leelanau Historical Society's Laura Quackenbush in 1987. And he speaks to the size of the fishery. At its peak, there were 8 fish boats. Again, Northport, and was even on the Leelanau Peninsula, was bigger. Beaver Island at one time was the largest freshwater fishery in the world. This wasn't a large fishery, but as I said, it's a survivor. And it was more than just those 8 boats, as this quote attests. There were people involved in shipping. There were the local farmers who were building fish boxes. There were the boat builders themselves. There was a cluster of individuals, in addition to the fishermen themselves, who were involved in the fishery. And again, some of Earhart Peters' wonderful photographs. The fishery itself has changed, and one of the things that, if you talk to anybody in any occupation, their knowledge of the lake and its ecology and the natures and habits of fish is extraordinary in terms of the commercial fishermen. And they've had to adapt to the changing nature of the fishery. Here's a couple other interesting graphs that show you today there's still, you know, there's concern because the chubs, as you can see here, have been the mainstay. You see this sort of spike here where the lamprey came in, and the lake trout, which was the money fish, as the fishermen called it historically, and the whitefish have been drastically reduced, especially the trout. And they're, you see the alewife incursion coming in. And at this point, it's now I would be reduced. This ends in 1974. But you see the nature of the changing fishery. So the early fishermen were catching sturgeon and herring, as well as lake trout and whitefish. There was a huge variety of fish compared to what there is today. Another way that the fishery has changed is you know, the size of the fish itself. I love this picture of Oscar Price with his 40-pound trout. That's not the record for Lake Michigan. I think the record is somewhere in the 50s. This is a large trout today. I don't know on the left. I don't know what the size of it is, but you can see it's definitely a smaller fish. So the fishery itself, as we all know, is in trouble, and the fishermen themselves are concerned about that. Of course, historically, they were able to roam all over the Great Lakes as far as their boats would take them, following the fish. Each area would have, however, sort of its traditional fishing grounds, and I have a map of that in a moment. But currently under the DNR, these are the zones. The lakes are divided into grids or zones, and you're given a license for a particular area. And so you see the chub area that in blue that Leland can fish today, and the whitefish on the right. Just a little bit about here in this I love this image. This is from South Manitou Island from the NOAA collection. But what it does is kind of show you from the era before we really had photographs. A fishing camp, and you see the basis of what the fishermen would have. You have the shanty where the processing would go to keep them out of the wind and any repairs of the nets, which are here on the net reel, and then the early boat types, the Mackinaw boats, and perhaps here a keg or a barrel for holding salt fish, which was one of the early ways that fish was preserved and shipped to market, often through the Great Lakes or by eventually truck, but initially by water or by rail. Those early boat types, one of the things that I thought was quite fascinating that Jim McClurkin, a colleague and a former staff member of the MSC Museum, has done a lot of work on American Indian ethnography among the Ottawa in particular. And in his private collection here in Lansing, there's information about building Mackinaw boats in Peshawbestown, the Indian settlement on the other side of the Leelanau Peninsula, as early as 1850. They were commercial fishing until about 1910, when they weren't able to keep up with the better capitalized European-American fishermen. But these are some of the first fish boats. And when looking at some of the history of the beginnings of fishing in these, there were Scandinavians, there were Irish, all of whom had been saltwater sailors or perhaps had fished before they arrived in North America and the Great Lakes. But there were people from Bavaria and Switzerland, you know, landlocked countries who would come and were braving these lakes in, these 28-foot maximum sailboats, at times going as far out as the Manitous, 13 miles away, and a number of them perished in the attempt. It was not a not an occupation for the faint of heart or the unskilled. You either learned quickly or you didn't make it. They were, however, known to be the best surf boats of their time and owed some design to American Indians, a native boat type to the Great Lakes. Fishermen worked very closely with boat builders. Some of them built their own boats, but in Leland, the majority of them worked with this man, John Johnson, a Swedish immigrant from Northport, who built most of the Leland fishing fleet. You see a couple pictures of the boatyard he was working, and again, the fishermen would tell him what he wanted and what they wanted, and worked very closely. Most of them had carpenter skills. They were jacks of all trades, as well as being expert fishermen. I love this quote from Bill Carlson, and here you see the transition in Leland from the wooden boats that succeeded the Mackinac boats. They were gradually enclosed so that protection from the weather, they could go farther afield with gasoline for steam and then gasoline engines, and then could do some processing of the fish on the way back to port. This image from 1960 in the top right shows the transition. There's a wooden boat on the left, and then in the back in the right, and the one in the foreground, the Janus Sioux, and the one going down the harbor are some of the first steel-hulled boats that were brought into Leland Harbor into the 1950s. So Leland is really a microcosm of some of the larger trends that were going on in the Great Lakes. And here you have the two fish boats that are active in Leland today. The trap net boat Joy in the foreground, built in 1981 with its large deck for hauling in the trap nets. And then the gill netter behind it, Janus Sioux, built in 1957 by the Marinette Marine Works in Marinette, Wisconsin, and then brought across the lake, the hull was, and then the fishermen themselves put the cabin on it. And it's still now the oldest fish boat operating out of Leland. But again, one of just two, down from eight in the peak. Here's the quote that the talk title comes from. And this is from fisherman Jimber Snyder, who now works in the fishery processing fish. He was fishing with some of the old-timers. That would be like Pete Carlson, Bill Carlson's father, in the 60s and early 70s. And describes what a number of fishermen speak to about the uniqueness of this occupation. And I was thinking, although it's not Great Lakes fishing, that like a number of these, one of my first folklore jobs, it was my first folklore job, was in Southwest Indiana in New Harmony, and there were commercial fishermen there fishing on the Ohio and Wabash rivers. And one of them, I'm just spacing out on his name, but he went up to Gary to work in the steel mills to make money as a young man, and just, you know, couldn't deal with it, and came back to commercial fishing, and made his living off the land for the rest of his life. And although a number of these fishermen, there are indications that they worked in the winter when the fishing season was closed in the auto plants in Detroit. Once this gets in your blood and you're out there in the lake and you have this experience of the freedom that these fishermen do, it's very difficult to have any other lifestyle. This is a quote that I really like. This is from Mike Grosvenor from the family that's run the Manitou Island Ferry Service for generations now. And there's been a symbiotic relationship in Leland between the ferry boat captains and the, you know, anyone that goes out in the lake, the captains on the fish boats as well. Talking about the community, it's sort of like the neighborhood watch of the lake, as it were, and the attitudes that they all have about taking care of each other and knowing when someone's out, if they haven't come back in, which direction they went, and looking after each other. And even today, with all the advent of charter boat fishermen, they still come in now. There's few commercial fishermen, but the charter captains and the ferry boat captain come in and kind of get together in one of the ferries, which has a bar now, and, you know, and have their bragging rights about their entries and, you know, the tough entrance into the harbor. Leland Harbor has always been a challenge. This might have been at its peak. There was this tiny little entrance, but now you have to make a curve, and you have to, even to come in after the, you know, federal and state harbor improvements, and you kind of ride the surf like a surfer and come in and make the curve. And one of my favorite quotes, one of the resorters used to, especially when it was so narrow like this, and the advent of yachts, the resorters would come in and they really wouldn't quite, all of them, know what they're doing as well as the fish captains were. They'd come in on a rough day, and someone described it was like shooting a goose down a bottleneck. You know, they'd come through and then they'd just be ricocheting off the sides of this narrow revetment going into the harbor, and it was great entertainment for a lot of youngsters. And one of the things I mentioned before is that, and Michael Sharapa has, the colleague at Western Michigan, has written about these generationally traditional fishing grounds for certain communities and certain fishing families that they've been going to now since the early 1900s, in the case of the Carlsons and other Leland fishermen. And this knowledge of the fishing grounds, the ways of fish, this traditional environmental knowledge is one of the things of this occupation that are passed on from father to son, from generation to generation. And you gain through working with the, you know, it's an apprenticeship with your seniors to learn the ways of the lake. And Bill Carlson is very open about how appreciative he is, realizing that a lot of what he knows he was handed, and that the generations before him learned the hard way. And the lake is not easy. It's not forgiving. So here you have two wintertime scenes. This is the first run of the Joy out in March or April of 2011. I believe that was this year. And then an earlier image of one of these tiny little boats just going out. They had small boats because the entrance to the harbor was so small, and so they kind of made their boats smaller than usual. And then they would have to put metal plates eventually or reinforce the hulls for some of these wintertime travel out in the lakes. Because today, you know, the fishing, the freighters stop running, the shipping channels close, and Fishtown Preservation doesn't want to pay insurance for the boats in the winter. But, you know, time was money, and so they would, as long as they could go out historically, they would go out in the winter, and more on that momentarily. We worked with the fishermen to do this map of traditional fishing grounds, and I think it's a really wonderful way to show this world that's out there that in the lake that is known to charter fishermen now as well as commercial fishermen, of all these banks, of where all of which have names, where they have traditionally fished for well over a century now. They are no longer allowed to fish in all of these areas since the Fox decision with the Indian treaty rights, but the vast majority of them they are. Basically, they can't fish in Grand Traverse Bay and these areas up here. And now between the Fox Islands is a trout sanctuary, and there's various other, you know, there are rules about how deep they can fish with this license and that license. But these are the routes that they're fishing. And you notice some of them are right in the middle of these shipping lanes of the Manitou Passage, where the large freighters also share the waters. The fishermen, you know, kind of divide their day and the types of tasks and then the stories that they tell about things that have to do with the lake and the shore, so lake work and shore work. You know, the fisherman's day, I must confess I didn't get up at 4 a.m. and take a picture in the dark. I mean, what good would that be anyway, for when they're leaving in the morning. When you go out a long day, and with these are not fast motors, for some of those far fishing grounds, it's going to take 3 or 4 hours just to get out there. That's a lot of fuel and a lot of time. But all the fishermen will speak in terms of sort of then and now, with the, you know, the speed of the boats, the type of nets, the type of equipment. Just a little bit about the nets historically. The pound net fishery, of course, not unique to Leland, but here you have an image of a pound net, a type of net that was of Scots origin that was introduced into the Great Lakes about 1830. Used in Leland along the shore, and here you have one of Earhart Peters' photographs in the lower left of a... They would actually take their larger boats out and then have these skiffs. These are boats, nets that are staked into the bottom of the lake. Today's trap nets are a similar type of impoundment idea, although they're in deeper water and they're held in the bottom with long leads and anchors now. But they would, during the summer months, the whitefish would congregate on the shore, and the fishermen would do that, and they would pound in the stakes with these pile drivers that you see here in the lower right. And the fishermen, there were two of them in Leland, they would share them, and they would go out and they would set the nets in the beginning of the season with these pile drivers, and then they would also pull them up. And they made those drivers, and Roy Buckler, another early fisherman, said, you know, we go out to a swamp, get some cedar logs, and put one together. Gill nets are still, of course, used today, and one of the oldest types of net on the Great Lakes of American Indian origin. Here you have one of Earhart Peters' photographs from the 30s of setting gill nets off the back of one of these fan-tailed open boats, as they're called, the round fan-tail. And this knowledge of where to find fish in that maze of banks is one of the skills of a commercial fisherman. The old timers didn't have the fish finders, the sonar, the equipment that we have today. And today's generation of fishermen who are in their 60s who fished with them would say men like Pete Carlson had this uncanny knowledge of where the fish were. They'd be going out there and they'd say, oh, I think we're going to go down to, you know, such and such a bank. I think the chubs will be hitting. And they'd go down and set a net, and it would just be full of chubs. I mean, whereas today's fisherman, Alan Priest, is the one that takes out the Janus Sue. He's the captain of the Janus Sue, the gill netter that fishes for chubs. You know, he keeps a log. The old timers didn't keep a log, you know, where he was finding fish. You know, it's just, not that Alan's not a good fisherman, but they themselves speak of these old timers with their knowledge of sort of feel and the structures of the lake based on experience that today's fishermen maybe don't cultivate because they don't need to. They have all the fish finders and so forth. This is one of my favorite quotes to give a feel for life on the lakes and of a fisherman. And you think of, you know, going out in the winter months with ice on your hands. I mean, that just gives you an image of how tough these fishermen were in the days when they were fishing as long into the winter months as they could. And here's a fairly telling image of why it's sooner or later you really need to kind of give up and recognize that it was time to put the boat in for dry dock for the winter. The ferry, by the way, went year-round, but the fish boats, eventually the harbor would get iced in, and actually the ferry boat captain might be, sometimes he had to spend several months out in the Manitous. He wasn't able to get back in because something like this was choking the passage in between, or the harbor was just frozen, and maybe they'd have to go around somewhere else where perhaps the harbor wasn't. One of my favorite stories was told by a man, Dick Carlson, who lives in Grand Rapids now. His father was a commercial fisherman, and they were out in a boat, and you know, they go out and you have open water, but the winds will change, the ice will shift, and they're out there and they're in between two flows. And they've got the flow on one side's not moving, and the wind is pushing the other one right at them. And there's no place they can go. They're just waiting for this thing to come. And thought that it was basically going to crush the boat. You know, these are wooden-hulled boats. And through some miracle, it came up, hit the side of the boat, and popped it up on top of the ice. So there they were sitting, and they were able to walk some miles, either to Glen Haven or to the Manitous to get help. The other story, which I find this hard to believe that the Coast Guard would be quite this gullible, but this is the story they tell in Leland, that in situations like this, they go out in the spring, they're eager to get going again, they see some open water, they would sometimes dynamite the harbor to get the ice, sometimes that worked, sometimes it didn't, to get out of the harbor, to set their nets in the spring. Usually in March was the first time they would be able to get out. This year it was April. And so they're out there, and then the ice starts moving again in a situation like this, they get stuck. And so one boat would get out, the other would see that this boat was out, so there'd be a bunch of them out just like this, and they'd be stuck, and they couldn't get back in. And so they called the Coast Guard. So the Coast Guard icebreaker would have to come and break a path and so that they could get back in the harbor, and then the ice would be broken up so that they could go out again the next day. Now, you'd think the Coast Guard would catch on, but maybe, I don't know, do we have any Coast Guard people here? Maybe they're just obligated to come, but this was sort of the racket that the fishermen had going there to get out. Whoops. But it wasn't always, I mean, that's an amusing story, but there have been times when they've been going out and they would get caught. Here you see some between these icebergs, and it would actually crack the ribs in the boat, a hole in the side. And this night of horror was actually in 1957 when there were three boats out there that got caught that gravely damaged, wooden fish boats. And this was actually the motivation for getting those steel-held boats from the Marinette Corporation, because they didn't want to, they were safer steel hulls, and their boats had been so badly damaged that they were not able to fish in them. And just want to share with you this this description of see if I can find it. I guess it's not where I thought it was, but the descriptions of the grinding and the pounding of this ice on the hull of the boats was a horrifying and terrifying experience for fishermen. Yet they continued to go out to basically lift their nets, because the nets were worth a lot of money, and if they were out there and the ice came in and they couldn't get to them, they lost not only a lot of fish but a lot of inventory of their nets and a lot of expense. I'd like to close with this, what I call the formative narrative for Fishtown. And it has to do with the danger of wooden boats and gasoline engines. not a great combination, even though when you're out in all this water, but water doesn't put out a gasoline fire. And in the history of Fishtown, there's only been two fatalities of commercial fishermen. One was Will Carlson on August 5th, 1941, that I'm going to close with this story, and the other was in 1998 when the fishermen of the Joy, the trap net boat that still fished, it was a beautiful day, sort of a freak accident when their skiff somehow got the weights or anchors down in their trap nets, pulled it over, and he was hit by a piece of wood and knocked him out, and he drowned on an absolutely gorgeous, flat May day or April day. So, but this instance with the wooden boats and the gas engines had to do with Will Carlson and his son Pete. It was Will's father, Nels, who was the first Carlson, a Swedish immigrant who came to this area and was the first generation of Carlsons. You see the boat, the Diamond, here with Will in the back and Pete in the front. This was their fish boat, and they were out in one of those, the farthest banks that you could be at from the other side of North Manitou Island, from Leland. In August 1941, when the carburetor line broke and started this gasoline fire, and they weren't able to put it out. Again, water isn't able to work on, and there, as I recall, their fire extinguisher wasn't sufficient either, so they had to take to the water. They had these cork life preservers, and this was August, and so they were out there, and initially no one knew where they were, that there was any problem. And so they're treading water. They were 8 miles from North Manitou Island. Will was in his 60s at the time, early 60s. Apparently the two of them talked about the next boat they were going to build and what they were going to do when they were out there and sort of planning for the future. And Will eventually cramped up. He died, and the son, Pete, carried him for 7 hours in the water, just hoping to hold on to his body, eventually had to let him go. He was in the water for 20 hours. Meanwhile, on shore, they've realized that there's a problem, and they sent him, you know, out, and eventually he sees the ferry go in the distance, other boats. By the time he was finally rescued, in the middle of the morning, he'd been in the water for 20 hours. He was 2 miles from North Manitou Island, so he'd both swum and drifted 6 miles during that time. But the boat was destroyed. And so the community basically came together and raised money to build them a new boat. He didn't have the resources to do it. He wasn't even sure he could go out in the water again. He would have nightmares about, you know, being swimming, and finally he went out with a longtime fishing partner just to see if he could handle it on the water again. And his wife Rita here named the boat the Goodwill, named both for her late husband Will Carlson and for the goodwill of the people, as the quote goes. And what's extraordinary here and sort of poignant is that this incident and the community came together. This is the family that is continuing the fishery today. And had this not happened, I mean, who knows what would have transpired in the history of Fishtown. But the Goodwill was the last wooden boat to be built in Fishtown by John Johnson, who I showed you before. One of the larger wooden fish boats. This type of boat was sort of the model for the iron boats that succeeded it. And so here you have the Goodwill coming into Leland Harbor. And the Carlsons, as I said, are about to transfer the fishery to the fifth generation interestingly enough, a young man with a degree in natural resources and fisheries from the University of Michigan, whose name is Nels Carlson, which is the name of his great-great-grandfather, who was the first Carlson to fish in Leland. So I'll end it there and see if you have any questions. It came from a variety of sources. The Earhart Peters collection is at the Leland Awe Historical Society, and they have been a repository for a number of scrapbooks and family collections that have been either donated or collected over the years. And there's Fishtown Preservation has also been collecting photographs, and we got some family scrapbooks that just came in the summer of 2001 that, you know, each one has sort of a different piece and a different image. There's also the Leland Awe Enterprise has a number of photographs, so there's a tremendous richness of photographs about the history of Leland, especially its fishery. But I would say the main reason there's, you know, there are a lot of summer people who for generations have been coming up, and they would have photographs as well, more of Fishtown than of actual fishing. But it's but both, because some of them went out, some of the fishermen worked at a certain point as fishing guides and took some summer people out on their boats. And there are some family photographs of those kinds of things as well. But it's Earhart Peters' collection, which is really the core of it. Yeah. Was Mary, did you have a question?
Yeah.
You know, I have a file back home that has that information in it, but I don't have it off the top of my head. But it's all driven by, you know, the price per pound of fish. So that, and that has varied, you know, so that in the early 1900s, I know that they were making, you know, they might make $17,000 a year, but they had a lot of money invested in, you know, one year they might have to buy nets and boats and, you know, property and this kind of thing. So I'm not sure what the actual income is.
Well, the follow-up to that, I mean, you raised, what is a workable living wage? And could you make it as a fisherman, or did they really all have to run down the auto plants and elsewhere and work in winter?
For during the period, especially during the 1930s and the 40s, up until the Lamprey hit, it was definitely a working a wage for them. Trout was getting up to 18 to almost sometimes 20 some cents a pound. The trout were really good at that time. The trout were the money fish, as they said. They would fish, you know, take these chances and fish as long into the season as they could and dynamite to get out of the harbor so they could get back, because, you know, selling the fish was the money, and the fish buyers would come, and they had a big lift in the fall in which they would kind of contract, and then they would pay them according to the market prices. Their markets were Chicago, New York, Detroit, kosher markets for the smoked fish, and they had sturgeon roe, and then later chub roe, also for the kosher markets. So it was dependent upon the price of, you know, some of them went to Florida and spent the winter. Others would have another job in the wintertime. But mostly the wintertime they could be repairing nets, working on their boats, there were jobs that they did, and sitting in their shanties and having a few and telling some stories as well. Yes?
Well, do they have an optimistic feeling about the future, or do they ever worry about the closing of the fishery?
Oh, I think they have a very guarded view of the future, because these are guys that are out there seeing what's going on to the ecology of the lake and the devastation wrought by invasive species, and as sort of one of the most recent dire threats, pollution, and government regulation, which they view as a real thorn in their side. Because I think a lot of fishermen, although there are fishermen that are working in partnership with studies by the DNR and research universities, they feel that they know the lake better than anybody from all these years of experience and being out there. But you also have to be savvy, and a lot of fishermen are now doing what the Carlsons are and are marketing and distributing. So the vast majority of the fish that they're selling are not fish that they're catching themselves. This year that they've been restoring and repairing the Janice Sue, the chub boat. She didn't fish at all this summer. So, you know, they're getting fish from the Indians, from the Petersons down, who are fishing for them out of Muskegon. They get from Cross Fishery up in Charlevoix from the fishery whose name escapes me in Mackinac right now. So they're all kind of working together in a way. But they're beleaguered and they know it. Yes. Thank you. Very good question, Kurt. I think the jury's still out on that. I've been spending, this was a year and a half project working with someone who's a very intense perfectionist. She's a wonderful gal, but it was a very intense process pulling this all together. And it was a team with preservation architects and landscape architects. They've got the collection there. I believe, maybe Maria knows this, I think there'd been some conversation about what to do with all the copies of this material that's there, and maybe it would go somewhere else as well. I know Sandra Clark, who's the head of the, what is it now, the museum, and what else? Historical Center, has been on the, been working with Fishtown Preservation Society on their interpretive plan for the site, so she's kind of on top of all this. And Michael Sharapa, who I mentioned, has enough material to write a book. I do too. We've just got to kind of figure out what's next. And there's a tremendous amount of material that, in the short term, our report is going to be published in a streamlined version with money from the Michigan Humanities Council. How many copies of that? And you know, right now there's just a few printed copies. But the report includes all my history plus all the technical drawings by the architects and their treatment recommendations for the site. So it's a complex, many-headed beast. Yeah, it would. Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm. Right.
But when they laid out in the lake itself, when they laid out the square, any idea when that was done or why?
When they laid out
the lake is divided into sections, I guess you call it, where you've got the DNR set aside fishing rights for certain groups and so on. But that whole lake, Lake Michigan, is platted out in your slide. It shows.
Oh, the grids?
The grids.
I should know that, and the Fisheries and Wildlife, but it would have happened either in the 60s or the 70s at one time. Right, right. No. But that sketch comes from one Hubbard's field notebooks from that trip, you know, which the original's at the Bentley in Ann Arbor. It's just amazing that it happens to be Leland that he sketched in such detail.
Well, I think we've got it off, but one